Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita Ki. So today we're reading from Madhya Leela, chapter 4, text 136 and 137. And on the board is 137. So translation for 136. When the story about the pot of sweet rice was explained to him in detail, Sri Madhavendra Puri at once became absorbed in ecstatic love of Krishna. So this is continuing on from yesterday's Leela, when the pujari comes to the marketplace and calls out for Madhavendra Puri. So he relates the story to him, how he has been ordered to deliver this sweet rice to him by the deity himself. And so, on hearing this, Madhavendra Puri is becoming absorbed in ecstatic love of Krishna. Then today's text, text 137, translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Upon seeing the ecstatic loving symptoms manifest in Srila Madhavendra Puri, the priest was struck with wonder. He could understand why Krishna had become so much obliged to him, and he saw that Krishna's action was befitting. Purport. A devotee can bring Krishna perfectly under his control. This is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam 10.14.3. Ajita jito piyasi tais trilokyam. Krishna is never conquered by anyone, but a devotee can conquer him through devotional service. As stated in the Brahma Samhita 5.33, Videshu durlabham adurlabham atma bhakto. One cannot understand Krishna simply by reading Vedic literature. Although all Vedic literature is meant for understanding Krishna, one cannot understand Krishna without being a lover of Krishna. Therefore, along with the reading of Vedic literature, Svadhyaya, one must engage in devotional worship of the deity, Archana Vitti. Together, these will enhance the devotee's transcendental understanding of devotional service. Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte Karaye Udai. Love of Godhead is dormant within everyone's heart, and if one simply follows the standard process of devotional service, it is awakened. But foolish mundane people who simply read about Krishna mistakenly think that he is immoral or criminal. Srila Prabhupada Ki. This is one of these back-to-basics verses that really gives us the correct mood and approach to devotional life. Most of the time we are emphasizing the need to read, the need to study, svadhyaya, the need to become immersed in Vedic literature. And actually there's nothing in this verse that contradicts that. But there's also another angle that's given, another dimension, that reading alone is not the full picture. There is something more that's required. Now, of course, reading, studying, meditating on the Supreme Lord is actually sufficient in itself. So often when these statements are given, one direction to consider is that typically when Vedic literature is mentioned, in terms of people's traditional understanding of Vedic literature, it refers to the four Vedas and different items that come as a consequence of those four Vedas. That's typically what is referred to when the old Mayavadi sannyasis would talk about reading Vedanta, reading Vedic literature. They would be referring to those portions particularly. So although the devotional parts of the Vedic literature, especially the itihasas, some of the Puranas, and the Bhagavad Purana especially, some people would not include those as part of the four Vedas, part of the original Shruti. They would consider those to be additional items added on later. However, our Acharyas, the Goswamis, have explained that these are in no way less than the original four Vedas. They are actually, in some cases, the Gita is considered the fifth Veda, isn't it? The Puranas, they comprise the fifth Veda. So yes, they are just as authoritative. And actually for us, even more potent. Because the Vedic literature consists of a huge range of items. And as it's described in the Gita, that one can become bewildered. Veda vada ratha partha nanyad astiti vadinaha. Bhogaishvarya prasaktanam taya parita chetasam vyavasayatmika buddhir samadho na vidyate. That by reading the flowery language of the Vedas, one's mind can become bewildered. And one can be set in a mindset of desiring material opulence, heavenly gains, things like that. So the original Vedas, they contain a lot of fruitive elements. They contain basically recipes for any person to achieve whatever they want without necessarily considering the inevitable consequences of that achievement. So people want different things, different types of opulences. Some want beauty, wealth, wisdom, renunciation, power, control, strength. And these are all to be found in the Vedas. And there are prescriptions for obtaining each one of those in whichever particular flavor one wants. So one can approach the Vedic literature and be completely bewildered by it. And so that can be a major distraction. As it said, vyavasayatmika buddhir samadho na vidyate, that the vyavasayatmika buddhi that's needed for attaining the actual goal of life cannot be manifest or does not appear when one's entire consciousness is engrossed in enjoyment or engrossed in plans for enjoyment. There's just no space left up there for actually contemplating the goal of life. So it is a kind of a realization or an awakening that many people have to go through, or maybe all people have to go through, as they transition from seeing God, Krishna, or whichever the deity they like, as being the supplier of their desires, to being in a state where they actually want to achieve the goal of life. So a person has to go through that transition, that at a certain point they realize that all these endless desires that I have in my mind and that I fulfill through following Vedic processes, they're actually not achieving the real lasting result. Because the propensity to keep wanting them is increasing. So each person has to go through that. And some people never quite go through that in any particular lifetime. So it may take many, many lifetimes. Maybe some input from pure devotees such as Srila Prabhupada or others who speak his message. But otherwise one can wander through simply looking for fruitive results life after life after life. And one gets slapped around by material energy as well in the process. So one experiences disasters. And then of course if one is somewhat pious, then they also turn to the Vedas to overcome those disasters. And they may have to perform acts of atonement in order to nullify the improper acts they performed. But sadly, as we know from the Bhagavatam, that this is considered, this process of repeated sinning and atonement, which is described in detail in the Vedas, is considered to be like the bathing of an elephant. It's considered to be a somewhat fruitless activity from the perspective of becoming clean. See, the elephant has a nice bath, sprays himself with nice water, sprays, as described in the Bhagavatam, all the she-elephants around with nice water from the trunk, and they have nice pastimes. And when the elephants come out of the water again, they roll on the ground and cover themselves nicely with dust. So all that cleaning was largely pointless. It had some effect maybe, but it was refreshing, cooling. But they very soon reverted to their natural state of being covered in dust. So that's the problem. That when we actually follow this path of fruitive activity, we are prone to committing sinful acts. And then to counteract those, we perform more activities, more pious activities. And the cycle just goes on. We make ourselves dirty again, we clean ourselves. We make ourselves dirty, clean ourselves. So this never really ends. And a person at a certain point considers that this is not ending. What's going on? So at that point, they need to make the transition from understanding that although the original Vedic literature is amazing, it is spoken by Krishna himself, Vedeshya sarveraham eva vedyo vedanta krit vedavit eva chaham. It is spoken by him, it is manifested by him. Its purpose is to glorify Krishna, its purpose is to help one realize Krishna. Sadly, one can get very distracted by all the other prescriptions in the Vedas. And one will realize at some point that it is not helping one clearly come to the path of ending this cycle of birth and death. So devotees all have to go through that stage. At a certain point, they think, look, this is not working. What do I do now? And that is the point at which the devotional elements of the Vedic literature start to become more prominent in a devotee's life. So the fifth Veda, those details which are spoken by Krishna himself, which give actual descriptions of ending this cycle of birth and death, as opposed to just being successful within the cycle. Those descriptions which give prominence to the process of ending this cycle of birth and death, they become more important for a devotee. So it is true that the original Vedic literature is very complex and very enticing for people, and therefore it can possibly help one realize Krishna, but typically doesn't because of the explanations that go with it and because of the mentality of people. So then one is obliged to take shelter of the bhakti shastras, and those cannot be considered in the category of being Vedic literature, which is knowledge supplying or facility supplying. You know, you read a manual because it might supply you some skills or some facility or some knowledge even, if that's your interest. But the bhakti shastras, they supply you a great deal of knowledge, but they also supply you something else. They also supply the actual techniques for becoming devotionally situated. So it's very interesting here that Prabhupada said that one can read Vedic literature, but unless one becomes a lover of Krishna, they cannot understand Krishna, which was the original reason for reading the Vedic literature. So one reads the Vedic literature in order to understand Krishna, but it is not possible to understand Krishna unless one becomes a lover of Krishna. So Prabhupada makes this very interesting sort of purport to that point here. He's equating becoming a lover of Krishna to being engaged in worshipping the deity. That's interesting. That's a very direct explanation of that. You could expect that Prabhupada could say something like, yes, one should engage in the nine processes of devotional service, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnusmaranam, Arshtanam, Padasevanam, Vandanam, Sakyam, Dasyam, Atmanivedanam. All of these are there, all the different stages of devotional service. Prabhupada could have said at this point, one should distribute books. All would be valid. But he's focused on one particular item here. He said that to become a lover of Krishna, one has to engage in devotional worship of the deity, Archana Vidhi. So that gives us a little hint of just how important this element is. Because actually when one engages in worshipping the deity, one actually learns to care for the Lord. Of course, it very much depends on the mood with which one approaches the deity worship. I personally don't like the word deity too much. In one sense. Because often we tend to categorize Krishna as a deity, because it helps us to sterilize or to remove the rasa from the statement. I don't know, sometimes if you've seen people when or you see devotees when they're attracting people to come to the temple, or we're advertising the temple, or telling people about the temple. We say, yes, come and visit us at Bhaktivedanta Manor. We have We have it's a nice rural retreat. We have a nice lake, perfect for sitting around in summer. We have some cows. We have a farm. We produce milk. We grow different crops. It's a wonderful, peaceful, tranquil atmosphere. You can come, you can enjoy. And we also serve free food. Yes, you can come and have lunch. Very tasty items. Free food every day. They say free food every day, really? So yeah, come along, try it. And then if you're interested, we have some books as well. You can come, visit the shrine. We have some deities. Then you can have some prasadam. You can go. So, do you see what's happened there? The deity is just an item within a shopping list of things that you can do at this theme park. Come to the theme park, visit this attraction, visit that attraction. And we've got some deities as well. So, sometimes we preach like that. Because we think, oh, the direct approach might not work, or some people might not be interested in the deity, so let me entice them with other things. And that all has its place also. We somehow have to bring people in. But actually, if we're deeply trying to serve Krishna, we have to really get off this deity platform. They're not just there just to make the place, just to make it feel like there's something of value to the place. They're not just there tucked away in a corner. It's completely the other way around. The rest of the place exists only for the pleasure and the service of the deity. So that's an interesting sort of mental shift that needs to take place. Sometimes we will glorify so many aspects of Bhaktivedanta Manor. We will glorify the buildings, we will glorify the grounds, we will glorify the facilities, we will glorify the activities. And they're all glorious, of course they are. But sometimes we minimize the deities. And that's a shame. Because it shouldn't be like that. It doesn't happen often, of course, but there's always a tendency, and I'm sure the description I've just made, which is perhaps embellished a little, you know, it's it's there just to illustrate a point, that it's very easy to just start assuming that the deity is another artifact within the museum of things to visit. Whereas actually the mood is, this is Krishna himself. Krishna resides here personally with his divine consort. He comes in this form specifically to accept service from us. And if we take that chance and offer him service, then he is pleased and we are benefited in the ultimate sense of actually being situated back in our constitutional position. So if that's our mood and mentality, then actually we view our worship and our processes in a completely different way. We don't just view deity worship as an optional item which is carried out by one department. We actually view it as part of the very, very clear process by which one develops affection. Now, why do I mention this? Because this style of mentality that I just described, it leads to a connection with the deity which does not naturally allow love to awaken for the deity. There's a difference between doing activities and love awakening. Deity worship, as Prabhupada said to one disciple once, who was saying, Prabhupada, I need some more service. Prabhupada said, don't worry, within deity worship I can give you enough service to keep you occupied for 24 hours of the day. So for some people, service and activities are required. And deity worship does supply multiple activities. But that's not where it ends. If we approach the deity as an item within the options, list of options, and then we will carry out many activities, the love aspect might not develop as quickly. Whereas if we consider that Krishna is personally present here, Krishna is present here with his consort. He's undergoing pastimes. Prabhupada has given us a list of items and a list of methods by which we can assist Krishna in his pastimes, by which we can please him and serve him. And then we develop concern for Krishna's welfare. And we develop concern for the care we are offering him. And just as Mother Yashoda develops concern for Krishna when he maybe eats the wrong things, or maybe when he doesn't bathe properly, or when he misbehaves, or when he's out all day in the burning heat, and she's wondering if he's going to get heat stroke or something like that. That's the sort of care, that's the type of feeling of love that comes when we stop seeing Krishna as a deity and start seeing him as a person who is available for us to serve by his mercy. And actually by the mercy of the spiritual master, by the mercy of Prabhupada. So it's a subtle difference. It's a difference of approach. Now we can't always assume that we're on the platform where we are thinking of the deity in that way. For some people it comes very natural, actually just thinking of Krishna. Sometimes actually many of our congregation members or our visitors actually have a direct appreciation of the deity as being the Supreme Lord and the object of my worship than we sometimes can do in the temple. Now that's interesting, because typically our congregation members who aren't actively involved, they typically do not follow a strict program of personal purification. I'm talking about the wider congregation. Generally, that's the case, isn't it? That they may come for Sunday worship, they may come for festival worship, but typically, a program of internal purification and ending the cycle of birth and death isn't the preoccupation during the rest of the week. So for devotees, that is actually a priority. That is the priority for coming to the temple, that one wants to make direct, tangible progress. So just look at the interesting way in which things manifest. Sometimes a person who is actually living in a situation where direct personal progress isn't the priority, they actually view Krishna with a great deal of care and great deal of respect. But sometimes when we're here and we're actually preoccupied with a process which then involves so many other activities, of chanting, hearing, preaching, cleaning, so many things that potentially now occupy our time, then we start to see just the deities as a component of that worship. So it's very interesting that there is no way that we can say that a person who is not engaged in the process of direct purification day in, day out is on the same level as a practitioner who is engaged in a process of worship and purification day in, day out. But just sometimes the enthusiasm that they display because they are away from the process and away from Krishna can sometimes be very inspiring to all of us in the temple. Isn't it? They come to see Krishna. They queue up for 2 to 3 hours. They bring presentations for Krishna. Now most devotees are trying to push in the queue. Forget 2 to 3 hours. If it's 5-10 minutes, they're trying to rush to the Maha. I'm guilty sometimes. So we can actually learn a lot from a lot. We can take elements of excellence wherever we see it. We shouldn't forget that the process that we've all committed to following, especially, I mean, the residents who undertake a process of being trained by Niskanchana Prabhu or Parama or Jagat Priya Mataji, they take on that role of actually trying to uncover something that's inside them and actually showing Krishna that they are serious about making some progress in this life in a very genuine way. So that's never to be underestimated. That is a very, very serious commitment. That is a very serious undertaking. And so we should always try to encourage that and support anyone who tries to do that. Because just the attempt to do that is glorious. And then we can also be a little alert to perhaps what can happen once we engage in the process. That sometimes that previous instant attraction we had for the deities, that might start to decrease actually. when we become preoccupied with the process. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. So sometimes we might need to be just reminded about Krishna as the person, not Krishna as the object that we decorate. This is Krishna, the person who's directly there. He's capable of directly interacting with anyone. And he does, depending on that person's connection with him. So that always remains the philosophy. And the potency of the deity, the degree to which Krishna manifests, also depends on the potency of the person who invited him. So deities, Krishna, Radha Gokulananda, personally invited by Prabhupada, personally installed by Prabhupada. This is exceptional. Krishna will manifest in a way through this wonderful form just because he holds Srila Prabhupada in such a dear position. In this, at the beginning of this purport, Prabhupada was speaking about a Krishna becoming obliged to the devotee. Isn't it? He says, yes, in the translation, he could understand why Krishna had become so much obliged to him. This is the pujari. He's realizing why Krishna has become so obliged to Madhavendra Puri. So us following in that footstep, in those footsteps, can also appreciate just how Krishna has become so obliged to Prabhupada, that he will manifest personally and will engage in activities with devotees and allow them to be engaged in his activities. There are so many interesting examples of this in the Bhagavatam. There is the wonderful story of Jay and Vijay, and specifically the cursing of them by the four Kumaras. And after the four Kumaras come to the entrance of Vaikuntha, and the doorkeepers Jay and Vijay stop them, and the four Kumaras do not appreciate that. They're effectively told, look, this is no place for young small boys, go away and play somewhere, when they wanted to see Krishna. So the boys became angry, and they cursed Jay and Vijay. And then afterwards, sometime later, Lord Krishna comes out. Lord Narayan from Vaikuntha. He comes out and he has a whole interaction. Jay and Vijay are kind of shocked. They don't know what's happened. They realize they've stopped the wrong people. Because they've just been cursed by four highly potent persons. And these four persons, upon seeing the beauty of the Lord, smelling the fragrance of tulsi leaves offered to his lotus feet, they're immediately having a transformation from an impersonal to a personal mood. Just the presence of the Lord has brought about such a wonderful transformation in their hearts. And then the Lord has a very nice conversation with them. And he apologizes. He apologizes to the four Kumaras. And he says to them, the master has to take responsibility for the servant's actions. And so you should consider that this offense was actually carried out by me. This offense was carried out by me. They're just acting as my servants. They do not carry any of the burden of responsibility. So please accept my apologies. You, the brahmanas, are most dear to me. If anything, and he says, I would not hesitate to do anything for you. He says, if my arm was found to conduct misconduct to any of you, I would not hesitate to lop it off. If my arm was found to be misbehaving towards a devotee, I would not hesitate to lop it off. Now, for the demons, they don't get that treatment. If you look at the stories of Hiranyaksha, who actually Jain Vijay then turned out to be, if you look at the story of Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, when the Lord slaps them with one arm, with one hand, the demon's finished. There's no question of him chopping off his own arm. The demon gets chopped. But for the devotee, Lord Krishna says that I would not hesitate to cut off my own arm if its conduct was found to be displeasing to a devotee. So just look at how obliged Krishna becomes to a devotee who is purely engaged in serving him without any motivation. It's a wonderful state which can only develop when one develops love for Krishna. When one follows a path of actually finding out about Krishna, learning about Krishna, studying about him, reading about him, and then engaging in a process which allows one to develop love without seeing him as a sterile goal or a sterile process, then one actually develops a real concern for the Lord. One develops real care for the Lord. How is the Lord feeling today? Is my conduct when I'm around the Lord, is it befitting? Am I trying to facilitate myself while I'm around the Lord? Am I making arrangements for my own comforts or my own auditory needs or my own this and that when I'm around the Lord? Or am I trying to serve the Lord? And is this his domain that I'm entering? It's a different type of concern. And it's a switch of consciousness which can bring about great results. We're after transformation, but sometimes the transformation side of it isn't necessarily up to us. We have to do something that actually pleases Krishna. If we accept the reality of the situation that Krishna is here and I am serving Krishna, then the more we try, the more of a relationship we'll develop with Krishna. And as that love progressively increases, we will actually get a sense of how to understand the Vedic literature. The Goswamis have written so much, they've supplied so much Shastra to us. We don't really, at our level, typically even get into the books of the Goswamis, the Sandarbhas and other things. We do study certain books, Nectar of Instruction, Nectar of Devotion. Those are the main ones that Prabhupada translated and presented to us as helping us to understand the science of devotion. But we haven't got into the rest of it. But they give very detailed, extensive, philosophical background and support for our entire process of devotion. When one engages in devotion, scripture starts to make sense. Even devotional scripture, actually devotional scripture is so powerful that one can just hear it and attain perfection. It says in the Bhagavatam, Yasya vaishruya manayam Krishna paramapurushe bhaktir utpadyate pumsam shoka moha bhayapaha. Yastyavai shruyamanayam, that just by engaging in a process of hearing about the pastimes of Krishna, Krishna paramapurushe bhakti rutpadyate pumsam, that bhakti arises. Just from hearing about the pastimes of the Lord, which are always complete with his devotees, the feeling for bhakti arises within the heart and takes away shoka, moha, bhaya, all of those things, lamentation, fear. So the process of hearing with full attention is so powerful that devotional feelings can naturally arise. That is the potency of it. But when one actually then engages in, for example, the worship of the deity, the actual service, devotional service, trying to please the Lord, then actually more and more meaning and understanding comes out from the Vedic literature. Comes out from the complex descriptions given in the Bhagavatam, from the extensive descriptions of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is by other standards of volume not particularly large. Mahabharata is large. Many other compositions are larger. Ramayana, others are larger. But the Bhagavatam is substantial also, and it's more than enough for us, 18,000 verses. We're struggling with that. We're struggling with 700 in the Gita. What to speak of 18,000? But 700, 18,000, 100,000, those 18,000 verses within the Bhagavatam, they are complex, certainly, but they're also full of nectar. They're also full of such devotional sentiments that when one reads those, one will be naturally inspired to actually try to approach Krishna in the right light. So we have to view this warning in the right context. Therefore, along with the reading of Vedic literature, Svadhyaya, one must engage in devotional service. Together, these will enhance the devotee's transcendental understanding of devotional service. So reading is not for us a goal. And so we should always be careful that typically when someone doesn't particularly like reading or doesn't like studying, they will take a sentence like this. One cannot understand Krishna simply by reading Vedic literature. And equate it to, therefore, reading Vedic literature is optional. That does not follow from the first statement. Just because one cannot understand Krishna simply by reading Vedic literature, it does not imply that reading Vedic literature is optional. No, it means it is still compulsory, but it is not sufficient. It may not be the complete picture. If one just reads without doing the other items that are actually also described within the literature itself. Within the literature itself, the need to engage in devotional service is described. So the Vedic literature itself never recommends you just to follow the literature. And neither does it ever recommend you to stop reading the literature. Of course, that's a bit of a contradiction, because if you didn't read it, you wouldn't know you shouldn't be reading it. So it's a very interesting dynamic. We should always be alert. Just be careful that a lot of presentation comes from what a person wants themselves. If a person doesn't like to read and to study, their angle may be that these things are optional, don't bother with those, just come here and serve, wash the pots, do this, do that. That may be their angle of presentation. Those activities are good, but they're not the complete picture, as I've said. Reading the Vedic literature on its own, it's not the complete picture. Washing pots on its own is not the complete picture. One needs a healthy, wholesome, complete, balanced program in order to actually attain success. The Goswamis supplied so much Shastric fundamentals, substance, as a foundation for our devotion, just so that our devotion would not be whimsical. It's all in there. The Shastras are there. Devotional Shastra, upon the instruction of Lord Chaitanya, was composed so that devotion would have a substantial philosophical basis. So if a devotee at a certain point continuously remains separate from the devotional foundation, their devotional progress will not be as complete as if they embraced it. After all, Prabhupada instituted morning classes, evening classes. He instituted reading of his books a regular amount every day. He translated so many books. If someone comes to the conclusion that reading these books is optional, they've clearly missed the point. There's no other way to put it. They've missed the point. But also, if someone comes to the conclusion that one should just read and read and read and read and not worry about anything else, that's also not the correct conclusion. So we have this wonderful balanced path in devotional life, as always. We have a variety of items to do, to follow. And they all achieve the ultimate goal of becoming a lover of Krishna. That's no easy task. You can see that when Krishna becomes obliged to a devotee, that's potentially dangerous. If Krishna ever became obliged to a demon, what do you think would happen? It would be disaster. We get a little hint when Lord Shiva or Lord Brahma supply the needs of the demons. They do so reluctantly, but they still do them because they're sort of obliged to. And sometimes they regret it. Lord Shiva regrets it when he offers the demon the head, the demon the benediction that whoever's head you touch will explode. And what does the demon do? Tries to test it out on Lord Shiva. Do you think if Krishna made himself obliged to the demons, things would be okay? No, they wouldn't. He's the supreme sustenance, the maintainer of the universe, the upholder of religious principles. And the demons are directly against those. So you never surrender to someone who's directly against the natural order that allows people to progress in devotional service. You can see how rare it is and how potentially, what a potentially dangerous position Krishna puts himself in when he becomes obliged to a devotee. So he's only going to do that under exceptional circumstances. Only when one has developed such extensive love for the Lord that nothing else is a factor in their life will Krishna consider making them part of his own personal body, as it were. That's a very high goal, but a goal that is very much reachable by the mercy of the spiritual master. Prabhupada in one place equates the study of Shastra and the success obtainable through studying Shastra to the degree to which we please the spiritual master. So that is another dimension to this, that Shastra and the results of reading Shastra, in fact, to even understand Shastra, we need help from the spiritual master. Because the spiritual master explains Shastra to us. So of course, for us, Prabhupada is there in the purports. And then so many others who take on the role of explaining Shastra to us. So that is how we can realize scripture. That is how we can realize the purport, the meaning of scripture in full. So I'll stop there. Are there any questions, comments? Yes, Srinivas Prabhu?
In the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's explained how if you do something with knowledge, then it's got results. If you do something without knowledge, the results is not there. So is that why the reading has to be there? Because when we do things with knowledge, then like you said, the substance is there. So we're doing a proper understanding of why we serving Krishna and everything.
It can be like that, yes, that sometimes when an activity is done with knowledge, it is more potent. Knowledge is not the only requirement for whether an activity is potent, though. An activity can be potent if it is performed purely without any other motive as well. Often we need knowledge because it removes all the, or it destroys all the misconceptions that are acting as an impediment for us to bring about that service. Often we have so many misconceptions and impediments and anarthas that practically sometimes performing a service is like you've got a handicap from day one. You've been dragged down right from the beginning. But there are occasions when a service can be performed even without knowledge, and it can be accepted if it is done purely without other motivations. One example, of course, is the chanting of the mantra by Ajamil. Yes, Ajamil chanted Narayan. He chanted the Lord's name, not with a basis of proper knowledge. He wasn't thinking of scripture at the time. He didn't have the scriptural insights manifesting at that time. In the past, of course, he had engaged in much scriptural study. But at that particular point, all of that was on hold, like a frozen bank account. Yes, you've got it in your credit somewhere, but you can't access it. It's been frozen, sanctioned. So Ajamil's mood was simply enjoyment, frustration. But somehow, out of great desperation, in a completely offenseless mentality, he chanted the Lord's names. And success happened from that chanting. And knowledge is there, and it's an important component of purifying ourselves in the long term. And when a service, when an activity is performed in knowledge, that is also more, you can say, stronger, more substantial. it's like a building. If it's constructed without a foundation, there's a tendency that when a raging wind comes along or storms, that it can collapse. Whereas if there's a foundation, the building itself will stay strong. Now the functionality of the building doesn't really change. If it's standing, the way the building is used doesn't really, you don't recognize the strength of the foundation necessarily at the time. But long term, there may be consequences. So in the short term, it is perfectly possible that maybe on the instruction of a pure devotee, one engages in an act of devotion which is way in excess of the quality of devotion that is offered by someone who is highly knowledgeable. That is quite possible. That someone, and we may meet them as we go out preaching also, in different circumstances, we may meet someone who has displays a quality of devotion to Krishna which is highly exemplary. But the thing that has to be considered to that is that in this age of Kali, in this material world, unless that person also develops a solid foundation of Shastra, that their current state of expression might not last. It might change. It might decrease and be lost. Whereas a person who undergoes a process of building up a solid spiritual foundation and then engages in devotional service, it's far, far more difficult for that to retrace. Much more difficult. But just we just can't judge the actual status at any one point for any one person. I'm sometimes inspired by individuals who I see not really following anything or practicing, but they display tendencies which I consider exemplary, which are in excess of what I might be doing. That's always nice to see, because Krishna can allow any person, and this is his prerogative. Sometimes we think that Krishna will only allow a person to do amazing things for him if they follow what I'm doing. If only if they follow the path that I'm doing. No, Krishna can allow anyone, even it could be an animal even, a dog, a cat, he can allow anyone to do something for him if he wants. No conditions. He doesn't have any conditions. He doesn't have a list of conditions that I must only allow someone to render devotional service to me if they do this, this, this. Those are instructions for us. That if we follow what Krishna is recommending for us, you do this, 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 this. He definitely tells us that. But as far as he's concerned, he can do anything and support anyone, however unqualified or qualified they are. So we always have to bear that in mind. Not be too preoccupied with the strength or character of our own process as if it is a judgment about what is acceptable to the Lord. That's a little tricky area to be in. There's one interesting, as you mentioned, chapter 4. Sa evayam mayate dya pura prokta sanatana bhakto sime sakachiti rahasyam yeduttamam. So Krishna explains that he's explaining about this transcendental science that has been handed down through generation and evam parampara praptam, and how this science was lost in due course. But he's saying, I'm now going to re-instruct this science to you, to Arjun. Why? Because you are my friend and my devotee. And therefore you can realize this knowledge. So he's instructing this to Arjun because Arjun is a friend and a devotee, effectively a lover of Krishna. And that is his qualification to understand this. So it's all a transcendental mix. All of those things are required. One has to develop the right sentiment. One has to get the mercy from the advanced devotees. One has to put in their own efforts to read and study. One has to build the foundation. And somehow if we keep doing all those things, then somehow they will interact and will be successful by the mercy of Krishna. Mataji?
Actually, the way you're explaining all this, like Krishna can be merciful to anybody, he doesn't have to be in the box. We don't have to. But that always reminds me of this beautiful pastime of the Brahman and the cobbler. You know? His simple little cobbler just sitting in the corner. You know, really, nobody cares. about him, but you have the Brahmana who has all the knowledge of the Vedas. But the Lord favors the cobbler because of his purity of understanding of him. And I find that very interesting myself.
Yes.
And also the other point you make in your class that that we advertising the manner, we're going around. Why is it that we don't have the confidence that to put Krishna forward?
Yes.
This is what we are. This is our Lord. This is his manner. This is his house. Everything else come after. Why do we come that? What is it? I want to know.
I've been thinking about that. What it probably is a sense of fear and lack of faith ourselves. It's lack of... When we don't have sufficient faith ourselves in the potency of Krishna, and as Prabhupada says, ultimately, you have to have... there are many nice conversations. You know, sometimes Prabhupada challenged his disciples and said, how do you know that Krishna is God? And, you know, they would give different answers. Different answers would be because it said so in the scriptures. And another answer could be because you said Prabhupada. And on one of those occasions, Prabhupada said, well, I'm just an old man. I can say anything. And so there's different ways, different things that are involved in accepting whether Krishna is the Supreme Lord or not. And so when we haven't got that ultimate faith, and Prabhupada said, ultimately, the faith comes when you actually realize it. When you actually know that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And when you can actually directly talk face to face with Krishna. That's when you can develop real faith. Faith increases up to that point. But real deep faith happens when you actually have a very, very close connection with Krishna. So for someone like Prabhupada, he has complete deep faith. He can come to any place, the most opulent place, a place which would have been seen as more heavenly. And he can treat it with complete disinterest. If he has complete faith and complete connection with Krishna. And when one is completely surrendered to Krishna and actually does not take any of the other materialistic presentations as serious or substantial, they can say a very potent thing to a person that others would be afraid to say things to. So those two things, I think, are the components, faith and fear. We're afraid, what will he think? What will she think if I tell him about Krishna? We're thinking that, to some extent, we've subscribed to this idea of all paths are equal. All paths are okay. We've done that, subtly, due to conditioning of society. We kind of follow that, actually. We never disrespect other paths or other faiths. But we should have no doubt whatsoever about the exceptional presentation of God and devotion within our scriptures, which has no comparison anywhere else. As devotees, we should have no doubt about that. That is a fact. So if we don't have complete faith in that, and we've still subscribed to the supermarket of options idea, then we feel hesitant, we feel shy to make this claim. You know, sometimes in the past, sometimes when book distributing, you can open the book to a page which has a picture of Krishna. Say, do you know who this is? Devotees have done that. Sometimes they do that. Sometimes it takes expertise to know what to say to which person. Now, the example I gave about, how we might present the manna with the deities tucked away in the corner, that's not meant as a criticism of preaching. Because for a particular person, that might be the presentation they need. But that's not that's not the mentality we should have. That may be a presentation that we do if we feel it will help them come in. It's a tricky one, because whenever you promote something that's not Krishna, you run the danger that when the person finds out about Krishna, they're going to be highly disappointed. And that often happens. So much of this so-called bridge preaching never goes anywhere. No one ever gets off the bridge. They're always stuck on the bridge. And their concept of devotional, their concept of success in life is, okay, you follow this diet, you you be nice, you be calm, you do this, you that, you follow a nice healthy lifestyle, you chant, you sing, you dance. Not about Krishna. All of this is useless if it's not connected to Krishna. All of it. So that's the real danger with it. But there is still, and this is the preacher's expertise, how to take someone from stage one to stage five without frying them out. That is a very, very strong tactic. Sometimes Prabhupada would chastise in conversations people who kept trying to bring up Krishna or God even. He says, why do you keep talking about God? I'm talking about science. And he was scientifically presenting the point that, look, if this is created, if this pops into existence, where is your evidence for it? And they would say, but God did this. He said, why are you talking about God? Just stick to science. That's all you can understand. Just on your scientific, on your false scientific basis, I will defeat you. So you have to say the right thing to the right person. And we will, and that's the expertise of the preacher. How the preacher preaches is not a defined quantity. They may need to say anything, as long as it's truthful and in accordance with the direct goal of bringing a person to directly worshipping Krishna. So if we're situated where we have faith and confidence, first of all in the process, because we are in touch with Krishna and are developing love for him, and we know that the goal is to engage someone in direct worship of Krishna, not any other substandard goal, then if we use certain preaching directions or strategies, we know they are a temporary strategy which need to be rapidly brought back on track. But ultimately it's faith, as your question is, it's ultimate faith and confidence in Krishna.
Thank you. And I was thinking as well, Srila Prabhupada was very bold in his preaching. And Krishna was always in the forefront, you know?
Yeah.
And that was, we can learn from that.
Yeah, in every place, Krishna was never hidden. It was, this is Krishna. We're the Hare Krishnas. We're on the street. We're not monks going out chanting. We're the Hare Krishnas on the street, chanting about Krishna. So it's just a different thinking. Any other questions? Comments? Gajram Prabhu? Seasoned preacher?
Thank you for the nice class. We were doing some bridge preaching in Scotland, you know, but we're putting the holy name of Lord Gauranga on the bridges.
That's a different type of bridge preaching. I was suggesting to him that we need Gauranga on our bridge over there, near the stream. That bridge has not been transformed yet. So maybe one day you may see Gauranga on that bridge too.
Yeah, direct bridge preaching.
That's a different type of preaching. Yeah,
we were thinking, you know, there's so many people that are not hearing, not getting the holy name somehow or other. So how can we get to so many people? So there's millions of people driving on the motorway, and then we put it up on the motorway on both sides, you know, both above. Yes. Then people are getting it whether they like it or not. And then we found on the, when we were distributing books in different towns, we'd met people who'd seen it and they were, you know, they were saying, Gauranga, Gauranga, what's this? You know, it was going round in their head.
Yeah, it's a special it's a special feature of the past. It might need to stay in the past, I think, that particular tactic, but it's been a special feature. Okay, thank you very much. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki. Srila Prabhupada ki.